Ian Patterson teaches English at Cambridge. He's published a number of translations, including Finding Time Again, which is the final volume of Marcel Proust's In Search of Lost Time, The Workers' Movement, and The Movement of the Free Spirit. He's authored a book of poems entitled Time to Get Here, and we're talking about a book just out from Harvard University Press. It's entitled Guernica and Total War. It's about what happened to the town of Guernica in northern Spain in 1937. It's also 70 years ago. It's also about the legacy of that bombing, the cultural artifacts that both preceded and followed it that relate to the fears and anxieties people had about war, about aerial bombardment, and about a host of other issues that suggested the coming apocalypse in the 1920s and the 1930s, the interwar period. Ian, what did Guernica signify to many Europeans in terms of whether something like that could happen to Europe's great cities in the event of another major war?
Well, as I said earlier, I think that there was a great fear in the 1930s, 1920s and 30s, that with the advent of aerial bombardment, the great cities could be destroyed. London, at that time, the biggest and most important city in the world, was an obvious and vulnerable target. And I think that judging by the number of popular novels that were written about this kind of fear, I think that it was, and the number of books written about how to cope with it, there were a lot of people who were very exercised with the prospect of total cataclysmic annihilation falling on their heads without warning one day or with only an hour's warning. The other thing they were afraid of course, was that the bombs that fell wouldn't only contain explosive and incendiaries, but also would contain poison gas.
What's so distinctive? We've talked for quite a while, and we haven't even brought up Picasso's painting. What is so distinctive and significant about Guernica, the painting, and what accounts for the tremendous impact that it's had?
Well, the painting is, of course, huge. And that's the first thing. It's huge and it's monochrome. And it's like a giant static, giant newsreel. And stylistically, it manages to combine modernist experiment with representation and Spanish symbols and a sense of silent scream and horror in a very effective way. But I'm not sure that the painting itself would have had the effect it has had if the event didn't come in a way at just the right time to make the impact it did. I think the combination of the way in which the event happened, the kind of use to which it was put, and Picasso's painting means that the symbolism was waiting for the painting to embody it, if you like.
Talk more about that.
Well, as I said, for really 20 years before the bombing of Guernica, there was a growing awareness and a fear of aerial bombardment and the idea that you could be wiped out from the air and that this might happen to anybody and it might happen to a whole civilization. And there were any number of books about it and films about it and non-fiction books and accounts of how to deal with it and how to build air raid shelters and what could be done and whether civilization would really put up with it. So there was a big cultural fear of this bombardment. Suddenly, in 1937, it happened. And everybody's fears kind of came true. And a few weeks later, this painting went on display in Paris in July of 1937 and was immediately made. It was copied, it was photographed, it was in all the press. Exhibitions went around Britain, for example, with reproductions of the painting and reproductions of the photographs of the destruction at Guernica. And the whole thing fused into a single propaganda coup, almost. The whole idea of bombing was symbolized by this painting. And very shortly after that, I think everybody who saw the painting thought of the whole business of the Spanish Civil War and aerial bombardment and the horrors that had been occupying people's minds all through this increasingly dangerous and difficult decade.
And there was another kind of propaganda campaign going on, and that had to do with what the nationalists, what the followers of Francisco Franco in Spain and their sympathizers and their allies, including the Germans, claimed about the bombing of Guernica and its cause. What did Franco and what did the Germans say?
Well, the first thing they said was that there hadn't been a bombing at all. No bombs had fallen on Guernica, and if the town was destroyed, it was because it had been blown up by the Reds, that they were trying to pretend that the nationalist forces were as bad as they really were. And they simply countered the event with lies. This is something that Franco perhaps learned from Hitler, who was always a big enthusiast for lies, and talks in Mein Kampf about the ease with which you can get away with lies, the bigger the better. He says that the really big lie is a very easy one to get people to believe. And the straightforward, flat denial meant that, more than anything else, confusion happened. Everybody who didn't want to believe that the nationalist forces were responsible, one way or another, for the bombing of Guernica, hid behind Franco's denial. Everybody who did had then to sort of go ahead and prove it somehow. So for the next, certainly for the next year or two, there was a huge media war between the two sides. The difficulty was that Franco's allies were on the whole in positions of power and authority. They were the Catholic Church, they were the, on the whole, the governments of Europe and to some extent of America. They were the conservative organs of the press and the like. And even the least partisan, the most objective, were unable after a while to say whether Guernica had really been bombed or not. So Franco's lie was very, very effective in muddying the waters and stirring up confusion for, in fact, for some decades after the event.
Decades, but Ian, there were eyewitness accounts, right? There were people there who observed, who survived. Why weren't those accounts taken seriously?
Well, to some extent, the people, if the people were believable, they were. I mean, G.L. Steer, for example, who wrote the report for The Times, which was also carried by the American press, was a near eyewitness. He got there that evening after the bombardment had finished, and he picked up German shell cases and all the rest of it. And people said, well, he was mistaken. Other eyewitnesses who were there at the time, Catholic priests and the like, were subjected to campaigns of personal abuse and vilification, and all sorts of lies were told about them. And the usual technique was used for most of the eyewitnesses, which was that they were untrustworthy because they were Republicans. And the consequence of that was that they were believed by those who supported the Republicans and disbelieved by those who supported Franco's forces, very largely.
As you write, people believed what they wanted to believe.
That's right.
Right. And there is another a big context for what you're writing about, which has to do with attitudes toward technology, toward machines, and in fact toward airplanes. And you write, interestingly enough and accurately enough, that airplanes were seen as bringers of both salvation. There was a great celebration around the advent of new airplanes, and there were heroic flights, and there was the aircraft industry was carefully cultivated in many, many nations, but that airplanes were also seen as bringers of doom, with this idea that you could peer out of the sky and bomb something to smithereens. The philosopher Bertrand Russell wrote an essay called Power in 1938. What did he argue about power and machines and perhaps airplanes and the dangers of what kind of new mentality might emerge given this combination of power and machines?
Well, he put his finger on something which I think is really central, which is that the power, at any rate, has always been hierarchical, and the people at the top have always been a long way away from the people at the bottom of the heap. And people have always, as it were, looked up to rulers, and the rulers always looked down on the people. But with the advent of the airplane, this up-down distance suddenly becomes dramatically exaggerated, that somebody who is flying an airplane above a country, above human habitation, is so far above them that he can look down and they can just look like ants. And technology in that case, argues Russell, succeeds in creating a mentality which puts into practice, gives a real practical form to what had previously only been ideological, that is, the sense that you are above people, you are so much more important than them, that they are just like little insignificant insects scurrying around beneath your feet and hardly worthy of your attention. And so he argues that this gives rise to, or can give rise to, a form of new mentality where people are so divorced from ordinary human fellow feeling that they have no moral scruples about unleashing tremendous powers of destruction. And this, I think, is something that you find in fascist ideology in the 1930s as well, a sort of fear of, or if not a fear, then a glorification of the airman, precisely because of this distance, this new distance from ordinary people. A hero with no ethics, with no morals, who can glory in destruction of inferior beings.
Yeah, he wrote in 1938 in this essay, Power, he wrote, "The man who has vast mechanical power at his command is likely, if uncontrolled, to feel himself a god." And here Russell is not talking about the Christian God of love. Ian Patterson joins us on Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Ian has authored most recently the book Guernica and Total War, recently out from Harvard University Press. He writes in this book, and it covers many different subjects. He writes that the bombing of Guernica in 1937 was the first time that a completely unmilitarized, undefended, ordinary civilian town in Europe had been subjected to this sort of devastating attack from the air. And he goes on to describe Guernica and the bombing of it as a cultural symbol. And you've heard him talk about what novelists and other fiction writers, and in fact there were poets and many other commentators who used Guernica as a launching point for what they understood to be either an approaching apocalypse or perhaps a scenario in which popular fears would be heightened, would certainly be heightened, and many of those popular fears became realized to some degree during the bombing of World War II, including the bombing of many cities on the continent and the bombing of London. And, of course, there was much bombing of the Third World, and you go into that as well. There was a tremendous number of casualties among the colonized people in places in Ethiopia and many other places where the colonizing powers felt that aerial bombardment was the way to go. Sigmund Freud, in addressing the question, and the question is, why do people enjoy imagining the worst? Because I guess, Ian, you see a sense in which people consume this kind of material, this fiction, because part of perhaps their mentality enjoyed imagining a cataclysm. You bring up Sigmund Freud's book, Civilization and Its Discontents. What in that book did Freud argue about civilization and aggression?
Well, essentially, the claim I'm making and the reason I go back to Freud is that we all like horror movies. We like to see things like Independence Day and all the rest of it. And Freud says that, in essence, really, that we have deep within us a very destructive element. And we have also deep within us very basic and forming fears. And that partly this is what goes on, this our ambivalent attitude to the fears within us are projected outwards into our experience of imagined horror. When we imagine the kind of horrors that we see in movies, then we're in some sense encountering ourselves. And similarly, when we're looking at the idea that our cities and our towns and our way of life might be destroyed, we're imagining the destruction of something within ourselves. And there is a will within ourselves, a sort of unconscious will, to do this destruction, even to destroy ourselves. And this comes into play so that we're not entirely distant from ourselves in our enjoyment. We're playing with something which is not quite within our control, something that is deeper within us, deeper elements of fear and destructiveness right at the root of our being. And this is why there's a sort of thrill to be had from an anticipatory thrill to be had from the contemplation of destruction.
Precision bombing. We see at that time, even then, claims that, hey, look, we may be bombing, but our targets can be accurately pinpointed, and therefore harm to civilians can be minimized. And I guess we're not talking about the bombing of Guernica in this case, a conscious effort to target civilians. What kinds of claims were made back then, and were any of them true?
Well, even just to go back a little bit, some people argued that the attack on Guernica was to destroy the bridge into the town, which was missed by every single bomb that fell.
Mm.
So if it had been their target, certainly they weren't very good at precision bombing because nothing came near it. But there were claims... Increasingly, there were claims as the technology developed that bombs could be accurately dropped. And to begin with, of course, bombs were simply dropped over the side of an aeroplane by hand. And then gradually, the technology evolved to enable bombs to be dropped mechanically. And then bomb sites were invented, and then bomb sites got more sophisticated. And with each technological advance, great claims were made for the improved accuracy of the technique. However, there is very little evidence that the accuracy was ever anything more than something like half a mile from its target. That there was the prospect of saying we can ensure that the bombs drop only on the targets that we have in mind and not on innocent civilians is still not within the scope of most bombing raids, even with the extremely sophisticated equipment of the kind of bombing aircraft we have today. In the 1920s and 30s and 40s, it was absolutely beyond the dreams of any of the technicians working on that kind of thing. And most of the claims that were made in the Second World War for precision bombing were just complete wishful thinking, or worse.
We have just a few minutes left. Another interesting part of this book is, so you document to some degree the ways in which popular anxieties and apprehension about war and aerial bombing were fed by popular culture, by literature, by art, by events like Guernica. And then something curious happened, Ian, when war was actually declared. World War II was actually declared in 1939. What happened to those fears?
Well, they suddenly seem to evaporate. There's a very interesting fact. There's an archive called the Mass Observation Archive in Sussex, which has hundreds of reports of people's dreams from the late 1930s through the war. And in the late 30s, there are hundreds of dreams in which people express the fears of cataclysmic destruction. As soon as war breaks out, these dreams stop. Some hand of realism comes out, and people, when they've got a task in front of them, suddenly stop dreaming on a large imaginative scale. Their horizons seem to shrink, and they look more realistically at what's going on and what has to be done. And this, I think, is one of the reasons why bombing doesn't work, because as soon as bombs do start falling on people, they start thinking practically. They start thinking about what can be done. They start thinking about how they can rebuild, and they start thinking that they're very cross with the people who are doing it, and they're not going to give in. Some kind of stubbornness as well as realism emerges. I think this happened in the Blitz. It happened after the bombing of Guernica. It happens with bombing all over the world. It happened in Vietnam. It happens time and time and time again.
Yeah, and in the last 60 seconds, do you think war makers have understood that lesson, that in fact aerial bombardment of civilians does not in fact destroy morale? In fact, it might harden the people's resistance and hatred of the enemy?
Well, judging by the rhetoric surrounding the idea of shock and awe at the beginning of the invasion of Iraq, it would seem not, really. The claim seems to be that the bigger the bang, the more people will give in, the quicker they'll recognize superior power and bow down in front of it. But I don't see any evidence of that having happened in Iraq in the last 3 years. Only terrible and tragic destruction.
We have to leave it right there. Ian Patterson, author of the new book, Guernica and Total War. He teaches English at Cambridge University, at Queen's College, Cambridge. We have a link to his new book on our website, againstthegrain.org. Ian, thanks for the book and for being so generous with your time today.
It was a great pleasure. Thanks very much for having me on the program.